The new physics, quantum mechanics, tells us clearly that it is not possible to observe reality without changing it. If we observe a certain particle collision experiment, not only do we have no way of proving that the result would have been the same if we had not been watching it, all that we know indicates that it would not have been the same, because the result that we got was affected by the fact that we were looking for it. Some experiments show that light is wave-like. Other experiments show equally well that light is particle-like. If we want to demonstrate that light is a particle-like phenomenon or that light is a wave-like phenomenon, we only need to select the appropriate experiment. According to quantum mechanics, there is no such thing as objectivity. We cannot eliminate ourselves from the picture. We are a part of nature, and when we study nature, there is no way around the fact that nature is studying itself. Physics has become a branch of psychology, or perhaps the other way around. Carl Jung, the Swiss psychologist, wrote, "The psychological rule says that when an inner situation is not made conscious, it happens outside as fate. That is to say, when the individual remains undivided and does not become conscious of his inner contradictions, the world must perforce act out the conflict and be torn into opposite halves." Jung's friend, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Wolfgang Pauli, put it this way. "From an inner center, the psyche seems to move outward, in the sense of an extraversion, into the physical world." If these men are correct, then physics is the study of the structure of consciousness. The descent downward from the macroscopic level to the microscopic level, which we have been calling the realm of the very small, is a two-step process. The first step downward is to the atomic level. The second step downward is to the subatomic level. The smallest object that we can see, even under a microscope, contains millions of atoms. To see the atoms in a baseball, we would have to make the baseball the size of the Earth. If a baseball were the size of the Earth, its atoms would be about the size of grapes. If you can picture the Earth as a huge glass ball filled with grapes, that is approximately how a baseball full of atoms would look. The step downward from the atomic level takes us to the subatomic level. Here we find the particles that make up atoms. The difference between the atomic level and the subatomic level is as great as the difference between the atomic level and the world of sticks and rocks. It would be impossible to see the nucleus of an atom the size of a grape. In fact, it would be impossible to see the nucleus of an atom the size of a room. To see the nucleus of an atom, the atom would have to be as high as a 14-story building. The nucleus of an atom as high as a 14-story building would be about the size of a grain of salt. Since a nuclear particle has about 2,000 times more mass than an electron, the electrons revolving around this nucleus would be about as massive as dust particles. The dome of St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican has a diameter of about 14 stories. Imagine a grain of salt in the middle of the dome of St. Peter's with a few dust particles revolving around it at the outer edges of the dome. This gives us the scale of subatomic particles. It is in this realm, the subatomic realm, that Newtonian physics has proven inadequate, and that quantum mechanics is required to explain particle behavior. A subatomic particle is not a particle like a dust particle. There is more than a difference in size between a dust particle and a subatomic particle. A dust particle is a thing, an object. A subatomic particle cannot be pictured as a thing. Therefore, we must abandon the idea of a subatomic particle as an object. Quantum mechanics views subatomic particles as tendencies to exist or tendencies to happen. How strong these tendencies are is expressed in terms of probabilities. A subatomic particle is a quantum, which means a quantity of something. What that something is, however, is a matter of speculation. Many physicists feel that it is not meaningful even to pose the question. It may be that the search for the ultimate stuff of the universe is a crusade for an illusion. At the subatomic level, mass and energy change unceasingly into each other. Particle physicists are so familiar with the phenomena of mass becoming energy and energy becoming mass that they routinely measure the mass of particles in energy units. Footnote: strictly speaking, mass, according to Einstein's special theory of relativity, is energy, and energy is mass. Where there is one, there is the other. End of footnote. Since the tendencies of subatomic phenomena to become manifest under certain conditions are probabilities, this brings us to the matter, no pun, of statistics. Because there are millions of subatomic particles in the smallest space that we can see, it is convenient to deal with them statistically. Statistical descriptions are pictures of crowd behavior. Statistics cannot tell us how one individual in a crowd will behave, but they can give us a fairly accurate description, based on repeated observations, of how a group as a whole behaves. For example, a statistical study of population growth may tell us how many children were born in each of several years and how many are predicted to be born in years to come. However, the statistics cannot tell us which families will have the new children and which ones will not. If we want to know the behavior of traffic at an intersection, we can install devices there to gather data. The statistics that these devices provide may tell us how many cars, for instance, turn left during certain hours, but not which cars. Statistics is used in Newtonian physics. It is used, for example, to explain the relationship between gas volume and pressure. This relation is named Boyle's Law after its discoverer, Robert Boyle, who lived in Newton's time. It could as easily be known as the bicycle pump law, as we shall see. Boyle's law says that if the volume of a container holding a given amount of gas at a constant temperature is reduced by one half, the pressure exerted by the gas in the container doubles. Imagine a person with a bicycle pump. He has pulled the plunger fully upward and is about ready to push it down. The hose of the pump is connected to a pressure gauge instead of to a bicycle tire so that we can see how much pressure is in the pump. Since there is no pressure in the plunger, there is no pressure in the pump cylinder and the gauge reads zero. However, the pressure inside the pump is not actually zero. We live at the bottom of an ocean of air, our atmosphere. The weight of the several miles of air above us exerts a pressure at sea level of 14.7 pounds on every square inch of our bodies. Our bodies do not collapse because they are exerting 14.7 pounds per square inch outward. This is the state that we usually read as zero on a bicycle pressure gauge. To be accurate, suppose that we set our gauge to read 14.7 pounds per square inch before we push down on the pump handle. Now we push the piston down halfway. The interior volume of the pump cylinder is now one half of its original size, and no air has been allowed to escape because the hose is connected to a pressure gauge. The gauge now reads 29.4 pounds per square inch, or twice the original pressure. Next, we push the plunger two-thirds of the way down. The interior volume of the pump cylinder is now one-third of its original size, and the pressure gauge reads three times the original pressure, 44.1 pounds per square inch. This is Boyle's law. At a constant temperature, the pressure of a quantity of gas is inversely proportional to its volume. If the volume is reduced to one-half, the pressure doubles. If the volume is reduced to one-third, the pressure triples, etc. To explain why this is so, we come to classical statistics. The air, a gas, in our pump, is composed of millions of molecules. Molecules are made of atoms. These molecules are in constant motion, and at any given time, millions of them are banging into the pump walls. Although we do not detect each single collision, the macroscopic effect of these millions of impacts on a square inch of the pump wall produces the phenomenon of pressure on it. If we reduce the volume of the pump cylinder by one half, we crowd the gas molecules into a space twice as small as the original one, thereby causing twice as many impacts on the same square inch of pump wall. The macroscopic effect of this is a doubling of the pressure, quote-unquote. By crowding the molecules into one-third of the original space, we cause three times as many molecules to bang into the same square inch of pump wall, and the pressure on it triples. This is the kinetic theory of gases. In other words, pressure results from the group behavior of a large number of molecules in motion. It is a collection of individual events. Each individual event can be analyzed because, according to Newtonian physics, each individual event is theoretically subject to deterministic laws. In principle, we can calculate the path of each molecule in the pump chamber. This is how statistics is used in the old physics. Quantum mechanics also uses statistics, but there is a very big difference between quantum mechanics and Newtonian physics. In quantum mechanics, there is no way to predict individual events. This is the startling lesson that experiments in the subatomic realm have taught us. Therefore, quantum mechanics concerns itself only with group behavior. It intentionally leaves vague the relation between group behavior and individual events, because individual subatomic events cannot be determined accurately, the uncertainty principle. And, as we shall see in the high-energy particles, they constantly are changing. Quantum physics abandons the laws which govern individual events and states directly the statistical laws which govern collections of events. Quantum mechanics can tell us how a group of particles will behave, but the only thing that it can say about an individual particle is how it probably will behave. Probability is one of the major characteristics of quantum mechanics. This makes quantum mechanics an ideal tool for dealing with subatomic phenomena. For example, take the phenomenon of common radioactive decay, luminous watchdials. Radioactive decay is a phenomenon of predictable overall behavior consisting of unpredictable individual events. Suppose that we put 1 gram of radium in a time vault and leave it there for 1,600 years. When we return, do we find 1 gram of radium? No, we find only 0.5 gram. This is because radium atoms naturally disintegrate at a rate such that every 1,600 years, half of them are gone. Therefore, physicists say that radium has a half-life of 1,600 years. If we put the radium back in the vault for another 1,600 years, only 1/4 of the original gram would remain when we opened the vault again. Every 1,600 years, 1/2 of all the radium atoms in the world disappear. How do we know which radium atoms are going to disintegrate and which radium atoms are not going to disintegrate? We don't. We can predict how many atoms in a piece of radium are going to disintegrate in the next hour, but we have no way of determining which ones are going to disintegrate. There is no physical law that we know of which governs this selection. Which atoms decay is purely a matter of chance. Nonetheless, radium continues to decay on schedule, as it were, with a precise and unvarying half-life of 1,600 years. Quantum theory dispenses with the laws governing the disintegration of individual radium atoms and proceeds directly to the statistical laws governing the disintegration of radium atoms as a group. This is how statistics is used in the new physics. Another good example of predictable overall, or statistical, behavior, consisting of unpredictable individual events, is the constant variation of intensity among spectral lines. Remember that according to Bohr's theory, the electrons of an atom are located only in shells, which are specific distances from the nucleus. Normally, the single electron of a hydrogen atom remains in the shell closest to the nucleus, the ground state. If we excite it, add energy to it, we cause it to jump to a shell farther out. The more energy we give it, the farther out it jumps. If we stop exciting it, the electron jumps inward to a shell closer to the nucleus, eventually returning all the way to the innermost shell. With each jump from an outer shell to an inner shell, the electron emits an energy amount equal to the energy amount that it absorbed when we caused it to jump outward. These emitting energy packets, photons, constitute the light which, when dispersed through a prism, forms the spectrum of 100 or so colored lines that is peculiar to hydrogen. Each colored line in the hydrogen spectrum is made from the light emitted from hydrogen electrons as they jump from a particular outer shell to a particular inner shell. What we did not mention earlier is that some of the lines in the hydrogen spectrum are more pronounced than others. The lines that are more pronounced are always more pronounced, and the lines that are faint are always faint. The intensity of the lines in the hydrogen spectrum varies, because hydrogen electrons returning to the ground state do not always take the same route. Shell 5, for example, may be a more popular stopover than shell 3. In that case, the spectrum produced by millions of excited hydrogen atoms will show a more pronounced spectral line corresponding to electron jumps from shell 5 to shell 1, and a less pronounced spectral line corresponding to electron jumps from, say, shell 3 to shell 1. That is because, in this example, more electrons stop over at shell 5 before jumping to shell 1 than stop over at shell 3 before jumping to shell 1. In other words, the probability is very high in this example that the electrons of excited hydrogen atoms will stop at shell 5 on their way back to shell 1, and the probability is lower that they will stop at shell 3. Said another way, we know that a certain number of electrons probably will stop at shell 5, and that a certain lesser number of electrons probably will stop at shell 3. Still, we have no way of knowing which electrons will stop where. As before, we can describe precisely an overall behavior without being able to predict a single one of the individual events which comprise it. This brings us to the central philosophical issue of quantum mechanics, namely, what is it that quantum mechanics describes? Put another way, quantum mechanics statistically describes the overall behavior and/or predicts the probabilities of the individual behavior of what? In the autumn of 1927, physicists working with the new physics met in Brussels, Belgium, to ask themselves this question, among others. What they decided there became known as the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. Footnote: this was the fifth Solvay Congress at which Bohr and Einstein conducted their now famous debates. The term Copenhagen interpretation reflects the dominant influence of Niels Bohr from Copenhagen and his school of thought. End of footnote. Other interpretations developed later, but the Copenhagen interpretation marks the emergence of the new physics as a consistent way of viewing the world. It is still the most prevalent interpretation of the mathematical formalism of quantum mechanics. The upheaval in physics following the discovery of the inadequacies of Newtonian physics was all but complete. The question among the physicists at Brussels was not whether Newtonian mechanics could be adapted to subatomic phenomena. It was clear that it could not be, but rather what was to replace it. The Copenhagen interpretation was the first consistent formulation of quantum mechanics. Einstein opposed it in 1927, and he argued against it until his death, although he, like all physicists, was forced to acknowledge its advantages in explaining subatomic phenomena. The Copenhagen interpretation says, in effect, that it does not matter what quantum mechanics is about. Footnote: the Copenhagen interpretation says that quantum theory is about correlations in our experiences. It is about what will be observed under specified conditions. End of footnote. The important thing is that it works in all possible experimental situations. This is one of the most important statements in the history of science. The Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics began a monumental reunion which was all but unnoticed at the time. The rational part of our psyche, typified by science, began to merge again with that other part of us which we had ignored since the 1700s, our irrational side. The scientific idea of truth traditionally had been anchored in an absolute truth somewhere out there, that is, an absolute truth with an independent existence. The closer that we came in our approximations to the absolute truth, the truer our theories were said to be. Although we might never be able to perceive the absolute truth directly, or to open the watch, as Einstein put it, still we tried to construct theories such that for every facet of absolute truth, there was a corresponding element in our theories. The Copenhagen interpretation does away with this idea of a one-to-one correspondence between reality and theory. This is another way of saying what we have said before. Quantum mechanics discards the laws governing individual events and states directly the laws governing aggregations. It is very pragmatic. The philosophy of pragmatism goes something like this. The mind is such that it deals only with ideas. It is not possible for the mind to relate to anything other than ideas. Therefore, it is not correct to think that the mind actually can ponder reality. All that the mind can ponder is its ideas about reality. Whether or not that is the way reality actually is a metaphysical issue. Therefore, whether or not something is true is not a matter of how closely it corresponds to the absolute truth, but of how consistent it is with our experience. Footnote: the philosophy of pragmatism was created by the American psychologist William James. Recently, the pragmatic aspects of the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics have been emphasized by Henry Pierce Stapp, a theoretical physicist at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory in Berkeley, California. The Copenhagen interpretation, in addition to the pragmatic part, has the claim that quantum theory is in some sense complete, that no theory can explain subatomic phenomena in any more detail. An essential feature of the Copenhagen interpretation is Bohr's principle of complementarity, to be discussed later. Some historians practically equate the Copenhagen interpretation and complementarity. Complementarity is subsumed in a general way in Stapp's pragmatic interpretation of quantum mechanics, but the special emphasis on complementarity is characteristic of the Copenhagen interpretation. End of footnote. The extraordinary importance of the Copenhagen interpretation lies in the fact that for the first time, scientists attempting to formulate a consistent physics were forced by their own findings to acknowledge that a complete understanding of reality lies beyond the capabilities of rational thought. It was this that Einstein could not accept. "The most incomprehensible thing about the world," he wrote, "is that it is comprehensible." But the deed was done. The new physics was based not upon absolute truth, but upon us. Henry Pierce Stapp, a physicist at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory, expressed this eloquently. "The Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics was essentially a rejection of the presumption that nature could be understood in terms of elementary space-time realities. According to the new view, the complete description of nature at the atomic level was given by probability functions that referred not to underlying microscopic space-time realities, but rather to the macroscopic objects of sense experience. The theoretical structure did not extend down and anchor itself on fundamental microscopic space-time realities. Instead, it turned back and anchored itself in the concrete sense realities that form the basis of social life." This pragmatic description is to be contrasted with descriptions that attempt to peer behind the scenes and tell us what is really happening. Another way of understanding the Copenhagen interpretation, in retrospect, is in terms of split-brain analysis. The human brain is divided into two halves, which are connected at the center of the cerebral cavity by a tissue. To treat certain conditions, such as epilepsy, the two halves of the brain sometimes are separated surgically. From the experiences reported by and the observations made of persons who have undergone this surgery, we have discovered a remarkable fact. Generally speaking, the left side of our brain functions in a different manner than the right side. Each of our two brains sees the world in a different way. The left side of our brain perceives the world in a linear manner. It tends to organize sensory input into the form of points on a line, with some points coming before others. For example, language, which is linear, the words which you are reading flow along a line from left to right, is a function of the left hemisphere. The left hemisphere functions logically and rationally. It is the left side of the brain which creates the concept of causality, the image that one thing causes another because it always precedes it. The right hemisphere, by comparison, perceives whole patterns. Persons who have had split-brain operations actually have two separate brains. When each hemisphere is tested separately, it is found that the left brain remembers how to speak and use words, while the right brain generally cannot. However, the right brain remembers the lyrics of songs. The left side of our brain tends to ask certain questions of its sensory input. The right side of our brain tends to accept what it is given more freely. Roughly speaking, the left hemisphere is rational, and the right hemisphere is irrational. Physiologically, the left hemisphere controls the right side of the body, and the right hemisphere controls the left side of the body. In view of this, it is no coincidence that both literature and mythology associate the right hand, left hemisphere, with rational male and assertive characteristics, and the left hand, right hemisphere, with mystical, female, and receptive characteristics. The Chinese wrote about the same phenomena thousands of years ago, yin and yang, although they were not known for their split-brain surgery. Our entire society reflects a left hemispheric bias. It is rational, masculine, and assertive. It gives very little reinforcement to those characteristics representative of the right hemisphere, intuitive, feminine, and receptive. The advent of science marks the beginning of the ascent of left hemispheric thinking into the dominant mode of Western cognition and the descent of right hemispheric thinking into the underground, under psyche status from which it did not emerge with scientific recognition until Freud's discovery of the unconscious, which, of course, he labeled dark, mysterious, and irrational, because that is how the left hemisphere views the right hemisphere. The Copenhagen interpretation was, in effect, a recognition of the limitations of left hemispheric thought, although the physicists at Brussels in 1927 could not have thought in those terms. It was also a recognition of those psychic aspects which long had been ignored in a rationalistic society. After all, physicists are essentially people who wonder at the universe. To stand in awe and wonder is to understand in a very specific way, even if that understanding cannot be described. The subjective experience of wonder is a message to the rational mind that the object of wonder is being perceived and understood in ways other than the rational. The next time you are awed by something, let the feeling flow freely through you, and do not try to understand it. You will find that you do understand, but in a way that you will not be able to put into words. You are perceiving intuitively through your right hemisphere. It is not atrophied from lack of use, but our skill in listening to it has been dulled by 3 centuries of neglect. Wu Li masters perceive in both ways, the rational and the irrational, the assertive and the receptive, the masculine and the feminine. They reject neither one nor the other. They only dance. Dancing lesson for Newtonian physics. Can picture it. Dancing lesson for quantum mechanics. Cannot picture it. Newtonian physics, based on ordinary sense perceptions. Quantum mechanics, based on behavior of subatomic particles and systems not directly observable. Newtonian physics describes things, individual objects in space and their changes in time. Quantum mechanics describes statistical behavior of systems. Newtonian physics predicts events. Quantum mechanics predicts probabilities. Newtonian physics assumes an objective reality out there. Quantum mechanics does not assume an objective reality apart from our experience. Newtonian physics, we can observe something without changing it. Quantum mechanics, we cannot observe something without changing it. Newtonian physics claims to be based on absolute truth, the way that nature really is behind the scenes. Quantum mechanics claims only to correlate experience correctly. This is quantum mechanics. The next question is, how does it work? Part 1. Patterns of Organic Energy. Chapter 1. Living. When we talk of physics as patterns of organic energy, the word that catches our attention is organic. Organic means living. Most people think that physics is about things that are not living, such as pendulums and billiard balls. This is a common point of view, even among physicists, but it is not as evident as it may seem. Let us explore this viewpoint with the aid of a hypothetical person, a young man named Jim DeWitt, who is the perpetual champion of the non-obvious. It is not at all true, says Jim DeWitt, that physics is about non-living things. This is evident from our discussion of falling bodies. Even if some of them are the human kind, they all accelerate at the same rate in a vacuum. So physics does apply to living things. But that is an unfair example, we say. Rocks have no choice in the matter of falling. If we drop them, they fall. If we don't drop them, they don't fall. Humans, on the other hand, exercise choice. Accidents excluded, humans ordinarily are not found in the act of falling. Why? Because they know that falling may hurt them and they have no desire to be hurt. In other words, humans process information. They know that they may be hurt, and they respond to it by not falling. Rocks can do neither. That is the way things appear, says DeWitt, but it may not be the way they actually are. For example, by watching time-lapse photography, we know that plants often respond to stimuli with human-like reactions. They retreat from pain, advance toward pleasure, and even languish in the absence of affection. The only difference is that they do it at a much slower rate than we do. So much slower, in fact, that it appears to the ordinary perception that they do not react at all. If this is so, then how can we say with certainty that rocks and even mountain ranges do not react also as living organisms, but with a reaction time so slow that to catch it with time-lapse photography would require millennia between exposures? Of course, there is no way to prove this, but there is no way of disproving it either. the distinction between living and non-living is not so easy to make. That's clever, we think, but from a practical point of view, it cannot be observed that inert matter responds to stimuli, and there is no question that humans do. Wrong again, says DeWitt, reading our thoughts. Any chemist can verify that most chemicals, which usually come out of the ground as rocks, do react to stimulation. Under the right conditions, for example, sodium reacts to chlorine by forming sodium chloride, salt. Iron reacts to oxygen by forming iron oxides, rust, and so on, just as humans react to food when they are hungry and to affection when they are lonely. Well, this is so, we admit, but it hardly seems fair to compare a chemical reaction to a human reaction. A chemical reaction either happens or it does not happen. There is nothing in between. When two such chemicals are combined properly, they react. If they are not properly combined, they do not react. Humans are much more complex. If we offer food to a hungry person, he might eat it or he might not, depending upon his circumstances. And if he eats it, he might eat his fill or he might not. Consider the person who is hungry and late for an appointment. If the appointment is important enough, he will go without eating, even though he is hungry. If a person knows that his food is poisonous, he will not eat, even though he is hungry. It is a matter of processing information and responding appropriately that distinguishes a human reaction from a chemical reaction. Chemicals have no options. They always must act one way or the other. Of course, beams Jim DeWitt. But how do we know that our responses are not as rigidly programmed as those of a chemical, with the only difference being that our programs are enormously more complex? We may not have any more freedom of action than stones do, although unlike stones, we deceive ourselves into thinking that we do. We have no way to dispute this argument. DeWitt has shown us the arbitrary quality of our prejudices. We would like to think that we are different from stones because we are living and they are not, but there is no way we can prove our position or disprove his. We cannot establish clearly that we are different from inorganic substances. That means that logically we must admit that we may not be alive. Since this is absurd, the only alternative is to admit that inanimate objects may be living. The distinction between organic and inorganic is a conceptual prejudice. It becomes even harder to maintain as we advance into quantum mechanics. Something is organic, according to our definition, if it can respond to processed information. The astounding discovery awaiting newcomers to physics is that the evidence gathered in the development of quantum mechanics indicates that subatomic particles constantly appear to be making decisions. More than that, the decisions they seem to make are based on decisions made elsewhere. Subatomic particles seem to know instantaneously what decisions are made elsewhere, and elsewhere can be as far away as another galaxy. The key word is instantaneously. How can a subatomic particle over here know what decision another particle over there has made at the same time the particle over there makes it? All the evidence belies the fact that quantum particles are actually particles. A particle, as we mentally picture it, classically defined, is a thing which is confined to a region in space. It is not spread out. It is either here or it is there, but it cannot be both here and there at the same time. A particle over here can communicate with a particle over there by shouting at it, sending it a TV picture, waving, etc. But that takes time, even if only milliseconds. If the two particles are in different galaxies, it could take centuries. For a particle here to know what is going on over there while it is happening, it must be over there. But if it is over there, it cannot be here. If it is both places at once, then it is no longer a particle. This means that particles may not be particles at all. It also means that these apparent particles are related with other particles in a dynamic and intimate way that coincides with our definition of organic. Some biologists believe that a single plant cell carries within it the capability to reproduce the entire plant. Similarly, the philosophical implication of quantum mechanics is that all of the things in our universe, including us, that appear to exist independently, are actually parts of one all-encompassing organic pattern, and that no parts of that pattern are ever really separate from it or from each other. To understand these decisions and what makes them, Let us start with a discovery made in 1900 by Max Planck. This year generally is considered the birthday of quantum mechanics. In December of that year, Planck reluctantly presented to the scientific community a paper which was to make him famous. He himself was displeased with the implications of his paper, and he hoped that his colleagues could do what he could not do, explain its contents in terms of Newtonian physics. He knew in his heart, however, that they could not, and that neither could anyone else. He also sensed, and correctly so, that his paper would shift the very foundations of science. What had Planck discovered that disturbed him so much? Planck had discovered that the basic structure of nature is granular, or, as physicists like to say, discontinuous. What is meant by discontinuous? If we talk about the population of a city, it is evident that it can fluctuate only by a whole number of people. The least the population of a city can increase or decrease is by one person. It cannot increase by 7/10 of a person. It can increase or decrease by 15 people, but not by 15.27 people. In the dialect of physics, a population can change only in discrete increments or discontinuously. It can get larger or smaller only in jumps, and the smallest jump that it can make is a whole person. In general, this is what Planck discovered about the processes of nature. Planck did not intend to undermine the foundations of Newtonian physics. He was a conservative German physicist. Rather, he inadvertently fathered the revolution of quantum mechanics by attempting to solve a specific problem dealing with energy radiation. Planck was searching for an explanation of why things behave as they do when they get hot. Namely, he wanted to know how objects glow brighter as they get hotter and change color when the temperature is increased or decreased. Classical physics, which successfully had unified such diverse fields as acoustics, optics, and astronomy, which had all but satiated the scientific appetite, which had unraveled the enigmas of the universe and rearranged them in neat packages, held no sensible explanation of this commonplace phenomenon. It was, to use the parlance of the day, one of the few clouds on the horizon of classical physics. In 1900, physicists pictured the atom as a nucleus that looked something like a plum, to which were attached tiny protruding springs. This was before the planetary model of the atom. At the end of each spring was an electron. Giving the atom a jolt, by heating it, for instance, caused its electrons to jiggle, oscillate, on the ends of their springs. The jiggling electrons were thought to give off radiant energy, and this was thought to account for the fact that hot objects glow. An accelerating electrical charge creates electromagnetic radiation. An electron carries an electrical charge, negative, and if it is jiggling, it is accelerating, first in one direction and then in the other. Physicists thought that heating the atoms in a metal caused them to become agitated, and this in turn caused their electrons to jiggle up and down and emit light in the process. The energy that the atom absorbed when it was jolted, heated, the theory went, was radiated by the jiggling electrons. You can substitute atomic oscillators if your friends won't take jiggling electrons seriously. This same theory also claimed that the energy absorbed by an atom was distributed equally to its oscillators, electrons, and that those electrons which oscillated, jiggled, at higher frequencies, faster, radiated their energy most efficiently. Unfortunately, this theory didn't work. It proved some very incorrect things. First, it proved that all heated objects emit more high-frequency light, blue, violet, than low-frequency light, red. In other words, even moderately hot objects, according to this classical theory, emit an intense blue-white color, just like objects which are white-hot, but in lesser amounts. This is incorrect. Moderately hot objects emit primarily red light. Second, the classical theory proved that highly heated objects radiate infinite amounts of high-frequency light. This is incorrect. Highly heated objects emit a finite amount of high-frequency light. Do not be concerned with high frequencies and low frequencies. These terms will be explained shortly. The point is that Planck was exploring one of the last major problems of classical physics, its erroneous predictions concerning energy radiation. Physicists dubbed this problem the ultraviolet catastrophe. Although it sounds like a rock band, the ultraviolet catastrophe reflected a real concern with the fact that heated objects do not radiate large amounts of energy in the form of ultraviolet light, the highest frequency light known in 1900, the way the classical theory predicted. The name of the phenomenon that Planck was studying is black body radiation. Black body radiation is the radiation that comes from a non-reflecting, perfectly absorbing, flat, non-glossy, black body. Since black is the absence of color, no light is reflected or emitted, black bodies have no color unless we heat them. If a black body is glowing a certain color, we know that it is because of the energy that we have added to it, and not because it reflects or emits that color spontaneously. A black body does not always mean a solid body that is black. Suppose we have a metal box that is completely sealed except for a small hole. If we look inside, what do we see? Nothing, because there is no light in there. A little light may come in through the hole, but not that much. Now, suppose we heat the box until it glows red and then look through the hole. What do we see? Red. Who said physics is hard? This is the kind of phenomenon that Planck studied. All the physicists in 1900 assumed that after the electrons of an excited atom began to jiggle, they radiated their energy smoothly and continuously until they ran down and their energy was dissipated. Planck discovered that excited atomic oscillators do not do this. They emit and absorb energy only in specific amounts. Instead of radiating energy smoothly and continuously, like a clock spring runs down, they radiate their energy in spurts, dropping to a lower energy level after each spurt until they stop oscillating altogether. In short, Planck discovered that the changes of nature are explosive, not continuous and smooth. Planck was the first physicist to talk about energy packets and quantized oscillators. He sensed that he had made a major discovery, one which ranked with the discoveries of Newton, and he was right. The philosophy and paradigms of physics never were to be the same, although it took another 27 years for quantum mechanics to take form. It is difficult today to understand how bold was Planck's theory of quanta. Victor Guillemin, professor of physics at Harvard, put it this way. Planck had to make a radical and seemingly absurd assumption, for according to classical laws, and common sense as well, it had been presumed that an electronic oscillator, once set in motion by a jolt, radiates its energy smoothly and gradually while its oscillatory motion subsides to rest. Planck had to assume that the oscillator ejects its radiation in sudden spurts, dropping to lesser amplitudes of oscillation with each spurt. He had to postulate that the energy of motion of each oscillator can neither build up nor subside smoothly and gradually, but may change only in sudden jumps. In a situation where energy is being transferred to and fro between the oscillators and the light waves, the oscillators must not only emit but also absorb radiant energy in discrete packets. He coined the name quanta for the packets of energy, and he spoke of the oscillators as being quantized. Thus, the trenchant concept of the quantum entered physical science. Planck is not only the father of quantum mechanics, he also is the discoverer of Planck's constant. Planck's constant is a certain number which never changes. H equals 6.63 times 10 to the 27th power erg seconds. It is used to calculate the size of the energy packets, quanta, of each light frequency, color. The energy in each light quantum of a particular color is the frequency of the light multiplied by Planck's constant. All of the energy packets of each color have the same amount of energy. All of the energy packets of red light, for example, are the same size. All of the energy packets of green light are the same size. All of the energy packets of violet light are the same size. The energy packets of violet light, however, are larger than the energy packets of green light, and the energy packets of green light are larger than the energy packets of red light.